So this next session is something that's particularly dear to my heart. Part of our Brave agenda that's resonated hugely is recognising the humanity in everything we do. And the human side of leadership is something that is often hidden and not discussed. And that's something that we want to change. So I asked three amazing and brave leaders to take part and tell us the secret and show their vulnerable side. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our three brilliant participants. First up, we have Michelle from Tesco's. Second, Pete from TSB. And last but no means least, Sil from Diageo, and most importantly, her other very important role. Some would say her most important role, President of the Marketing Society. So thank you all so much for taking part. The way it's going to work is each of them are going to take to the podium and tell us a secret, and then we're going to have a discussion. And if we've got time, we will try and get some questions in the audience, but we're going to see how that goes. So first up, Michelle, would you like to tell us a secret?
I will.
Thank you.
Okay. Hello, everybody. So, the brief to us today was to come and tell a secret about being fallible or a mistake or being vulnerable. And I was like, this is great. I've made every mistake in the book. My career is an absolute target-rich environment for this question. I've left jobs without knowing the next job I was going to go to. I've taken a job because I've lost my nerve in a recession. I've got the balance wrong between looking after myself and getting my job done. But the thing that Gemma was really keen for us to do was to think about something that might be a surprise to you based on the jobs that we do. And so my secret is that when I took my job as the group brand director at Tesco, I had no retail experience. Yeah, so advertising, yes, financial services, yes, insurance, yes, mobile telecoms, FMCG, food and cooking website, yes, yes, yes. But unless you count the summer after graduating from high school working in a mall as relevant to leading the Tesco brand in every market and every business unit, I had this much retail experience. But this is not a sinister story, so I didn't fabricate experience in order to get the job. I was brought in because the Tesco brand was in dire need of resuscitation. In fact, my CEO, Dave Lewis, has often referred to the job we need to do for the brand as really performing open heart surgery in public. And so what was needed for my role really wasn't retail expertise, it was brand expertise. But what I didn't clock when I first came in was that I was going to need to deliver this expertise into what was in fact an alien planet to anything I had experienced before. And in an environment where retail was the only language that was spoken. So I know everyone's been in new industries and taking new jobs and like, no, you have to get used to it. I am not kidding. It was a major, major shift for me. And to give you an example, some of the terms in my new glossary include like for like, IDG, IRI, SRD, front basket, back basket, colleague hours. No talking about sales, only talking about what a store took last week or took last period. And the most exciting of all is the months and days that we in the regular world are accustomed to associating with a calendar are completely overtaken by something called Tesco weeks. So it's not uncommon to be in a meeting where you'll hear, yep, moment of certainty is 37. And what I know now is that that means on the 22nd of October, everything will be good to go. So I found myself in this foreign environment alongside colleagues with decades of experience who had encyclopedic knowledge of exactly, and I mean exactly, what had happened this week last year and the year before that. And the year before that, down to what was on promotion, what were the competitors doing, were there any operational glitches, what was the weather. and I gotta say, especially the weather. So in the beginning, in my role, two things happened. And the first one you would predict, and that is that I immediately immersed myself into all things retail so I could better understand this new world. And the second thing that happened is that I started to hesitate to contribute in certain conversations where the retail acronyms were flying fast and furious. And this is because I had really deep respect for the experience that my colleagues had and this deep knowledge of the business that they had gathered over decades. And so in some conversations, I felt like I really didn't have anything to offer. But because you are here at the Marketing Society Conference, you will already have noticed that the one thing I haven't talked about yet is customers. And in fact, that was why I was there. Not to somehow amass decades worth of retail experience that very qualified executives had accrued in their careers, but to really bring the customer and the brand into every room, not just the conversations that pertained to marketing. And so I dove right in and started doing that, even though I recognized that sometimes my language was going to be as foreign to my retail colleagues as theirs was to me. But that's honestly how we are leading the turnaround at Tesco. We're combining complementary people, people who have deep experience and knowledge of Tesco, with people brought in from the outside to bring new perspectives in order to bring customer focus to the most incredible operation I've ever seen. So what I hope you would take out of this story today is that we often focus on what our job is and what those skills and experiences are. And I think it's equally important to understand the complementary role you play in an organization as a leader. And it's not always the obvious thing, but once you can unlock that, it brings tremendous success. So I like to think, what is it that only I can do? Whether it's a skill, an experience, a way of communicating, or something else. And once I've figured out what that is for every situation, to make sure that I do that first. Thank you.
Very nice, thank you. Pete, the floor is yours.
Okay, well, hello everyone. Secret number two. I want to share something that I've never actually shared publicly before. And it's something that actually, if you look at my CV or my LinkedIn profile, lays well and truly buried. And I've done my best actually to hide it, but for the first time today, thanks to Gemma's persuasion, I'm actually going to talk about it. In short, I was part of an enormous, spectacular train wreck of a failure in my career. Part of a failed project that cost people in a business their bonus, and also put me firmly on the career scrap heap in that particular business. And it all came down to the crazy game of golf. Now, to start with, I'm a terrible golfer, so please don't ask me to play golf. I've tried it, I'm useless. Last time I played, I hit the ball in the car park rather than towards the hole. And with that knowledge of knowing I was terrible at golf, I actually still joined a business that was all about golf. I joined a project within the AA. You know, the AA, they fix broken down cars, but the chairman liked golf. And he was like, you know what? The chairman had a shower revelation. We're going to get into golf. Utterly brilliant. And his view was, well, we can do this membership thing for like people that have broken down cars. Surely we can do it for golf. So Golf England was born, and the vision was, we're going to sign up every golf club in the UK, every golfer to this amazing membership scheme, and we're going to rock. Sounds easy, doesn't it? Unfortunately, sadly, it wasn't. So part of the problem was that no golf club's actually the same. For those of you that play golf or don't play golf, they're owned by different people, they've got different structures, all quite different in action. A part of my early work actually had to visit golf clubs around the UK. Now, I caveat this next anecdote that this was 2001 when I did this, but I visited one golf club towards the north of England, I'll say, and there was a sign outside saying, no dogs or ladies allowed. And I thought, I'm not particularly loving this at the moment. But the cost of acquisition that I had to acquire each new member was £10, that sparkling sum that, of course, we know is very easy to acquire people with £10. And the promise in the proposition that you would get to play, at the best, the luxurious golf clubs in the UK. Unfortunately, the business development team has slightly struggled. People thought they got the Belfry, instead they got Basingstoke Golf Club. The IT was also shot to pieces, systems didn't work, and the B2B sales team that was supposed to be out actually signing up golf clubs had single-handedly pretty much spectacularly failed to do that as well. So within 12 months of being in this catastrophically interesting project, I was called into my boss's office at the time and told, this has been a failure and you are now being made redundant. And for those of you that have been through a redundancy situation, it's quite odd. You go from being full on in this job, like hell for leather, to sort of going, oh God, what do I do with myself now? And I had a young son at the time. My wife was a teacher on maternity leave. So you have this kind of, well, I've got to feed the family and I've got a young baby. What do I do? And that was sort of compounded by the fact that within the AA itself, the Golf England project was deemed a spectacular, enormous failure. So much so that the CMO at the time wore a T-shirt to a couple of conferences saying, Golf England ate my bonus. Which certainly underlined the fact that it'd been a spectacular screw-up. I also went for interview for a job there at the AA, and the first thing they said to me is, we're not sure why we're interviewing you because you were part of that spectacular failure. And I was thinking, this interview's going to go well then, isn't it? So this was also compounded by the fact that I'd actually left a really good job at British Gas. So at the time, British Gas owned the AA and also owned a telecoms business. And the guy I worked for, Andrew, at British Gas, has said to me just before I resigned, he said, if you go to the AA job, it's going to be a spectacular disaster. You really shouldn't do that. You shouldn't. I said, no. I know exactly what I'm doing. So when I went back and begged for my old job back, you can feel the sense of humble pie as he told me it was no longer there. Now, thankfully, I was rescued by an amazing coincidence of someone that was on the board at British Gas, had heard about what I was doing. Actually, someone that I used to do reports for, who used to report to the then MD of British Gas. And I'll tell a small humbling story. I thought my career at British Gas was off to an amazing start. I used to do this report every week for the MD of British Gas. And I heard one day anecdotally, he said, you know, one thing that really matters to me is that report that Peter Parker does for me. And I thought, you know what, fantastic. I don't mind being compared with Spider-Man. So it was actually an old boss from British Gas who came to the rescue. He joined the telecoms wing. Centrica had bought OneTel, an Aussie backpacking, amazing business that ultimately got bought by TalkTalk. And amazingly, miraculously, he actually created a job for me that didn't exist. And he said, look, I know your track record. The golf thing's a blip. Let's move on from it, which was fantastic. And that role actually set up the rest of my career. It's from there that I moved into every other job and got all the opportunities that I've been hugely grateful to have in my career. I guess for me, though, the challenge is it's a moment I haven't really sort of reconciled. Being told you failed, being told you're part of a failure, being put on a career scrap heap are things that actually leave quite a few scars along the way, which is why I don't actually often talk about it. But I think with prompting from Gemma, actually, a moment like this is a good moment to say, look, maybe I need to accept it. Maybe I need to go, that's part of me. That's part of my leadership journey. That's part of who I am. And maybe now's the moment to finally pick up those golf clubs once again. Thank you.
Thank you, Pete. And I think that Spider-Man thing might catch on. That might be your new nickname. Sil, please. Thank you.
Okay. So, as president of the Marketing Society, with a conference and at a conference where the theme is bravery, what's difficult for me to tell you today, my secret is that I have earned a black belt in worrying, and the last thing I'd ever call myself is brave. Many of you have heard me tell the story of challenging Gemma on brave as a theme for the Marketing Society, and I gave her a whole lot of intellectual reasons why it was a bad idea. But the truth is, it was a standard I didn't think I could live up to. Brave was a word that scared me. Now, I've worked hard on becoming less fearful and braver, and I'm by no means done yet. But my goal in these 5 minutes is to get you to see that anticipative worrying doesn't do you any good. It actually does more harm, and it certainly doesn't prevent those bad things from happening. As Carolyn said this morning, we feed our fear with our imaginations. Mine is most active at night, and I dreamt dangerously and not in a good way. So here are five of the many things that have kept me up at night. I spent years fearing that my mother would die ahead of my father, leaving me to care for him, and unfortunately, she did. I worried that my husband would lose his job, at a critical time of our lives, and that happened the week before our daughter Alexa was born, and I was due to take a mostly unpaid mat leave. I was worried that I wouldn't be able to work. I really need my sleep, that I wouldn't be able to work once I had kids, because they would keep me up at night. And oh my goodness, they certainly did, as you talked about last night with Joshy. I was afraid that I would get promoted from marketing to general management and everyone would finally find out I was a fraud, and I got the promotion. And finally, I don't particularly like the limelight or these lights. I don't like being interviewed. I don't particularly like public speaking because in my head, I always sound like a bit of a rambling idiot. And that's why you almost always see me with notes. It helps me believe I'm making sense because it's written down here and it made sense when I wrote it, so maybe it'll make sense to you. But you can imagine I was terrified when I got the Diageo CMO job and knew that external speaking would be a big part of my role. The list goes on, but we only have 5 minutes. The American expression, if I had a dime for every one of my worries, I'd be rich, was completely true for me. In fact, I turned it into a fantasy. I thought, well, if I had all those dimes, I wouldn't have to work, and then I'd have so much less to worry about. Everything would be fine. But when I turned 40, the big aha came, and I realized I really wasn't getting younger. And honestly, there is no upside to aging with the exception of wisdom. And if I didn't really start to more actively let go of my fears and enjoy life a bit more, I wouldn't be leading the kind of life that I wanted to lead. I realized that many of my worst fears had come true, but somehow I had worked through it and that I was strong enough. And I had the incredible support from my husband, Roger, and my kids. So we found a way to take care of my dad. I took my maternity leave despite the gap in our income. I realized I could function on very little sleep when Alexa and Jake were babies. I succeeded in the GM job I had feared so much. And in my CMO role, I reframed public speaking and interviews, not as limelight, but as something that I needed to do for Diageo's reputation, something I care deeply about. I learned that anticipatory worrying didn't prevent these things from happening. I think sometimes we think that it will, that that's very, you know, big in our psyche. But for me, it did nothing but drain energy when I needed it the most. And the personal power that I gained from realizing the worst can happen, but that I would be up to the challenge, was immense. I still worry. I'm still sometimes afraid. But what I've learned is it is in these tough times that you need to trust that your resilience will see you through. So my message today is don't wait until you're 40 or older to actively let go of some of your fears. Consciously tap into how it feels when you trust that you're up to the challenge, when you trust that your intuition, your support will see you through. I really recommend that you do an honest inventory of all that you have faced and give yourself credit for how you handled it. I'm sure you did the best that you could. This will help deepen your trust that you will be able to handle whatever comes your way, that you will find a way through it because you always have. You didn't get to where you are today because of your fears. You got here because of your strength. And it is that strength that will take you so much further and make you braver. Thank you.
My goodness, thank you all three of you. Incredible stories. They say the boldest act of business is being vulnerable, and you've certainly all been incredibly bold, so thank you so much. I've got a million questions, and I'm sure the audience has too, and I'd really like to try and get at least a couple from the audience. But I'm going to start with you, Pete. We talked a lot about your secret and the fact that you hid it. I just want to understand a bit more about why you think you needed to, and I guess for people to be thinking about why, how they don't need to hide secrets anymore. Is it to do with confidence, to being afraid? What was it?
I think it's interesting, isn't it? And I think the conferences like this are really refreshing, but I was probably brought up early in my career and was schooled in the shout about everything that's made you successful and your successes. Don't talk about the things that you've learnt from things that went less well. So I think for me, it was almost a slight shame of, oh God, that didn't go so well, you know. And actually, I'd rather talk about the things that have gone well. I think also it's funny, going through the experience again of writing this down, thinking about it, went back to all the feelings of actually the emotions of feeling a bit like you're on the scrap heap aren't that great. So it took me back to that moment of having to go, actually, the feeling was terrible, but out of it, made me stronger as a result of it. So the feeling isn't bad if I've come out of it differently. And I think this is probably the first time in that 17-year period I've reconciled now that emotion, whilst it was bad, the output of it was good because it's made me stronger. And actually, it's okay to talk about it.
And what advice would you give to marketers that were in a similar situation, or business people that were in a similar situation today?
I think there's a couple of bits. One thing someone said to me actually about redundancy is that your role's been made redundant, you haven't. And that's quite an important distinction of this feeling on the scrap heap, that actually your role's gone, but you're still you, and you've still got a lot to offer. So I think don't feel written off. You know, use any moment like that as a catalyst. You know, I've faced a redundancy situation at least two or three times in my career, and each of them come out stronger and bolder. And I think use it as a catalyst and use it as an opportunity. And the other bit I'd say is, if I look back on that AA experience, I had a moment, I thought, would I have done it differently? Actually, you know what, I probably still would go for it now. Even if I had a time machine and went back, I'd probably be laughing all the way through the year, go, oh, I know what comes at the end of it. But but actually, I'd still have gone through it, because I'm not sure everything else would have lined up in the way it did without that year. So I'd say, look, throw yourself at things, even if the things that, I was half joking about the golf thing, I am a lousy golfer, but, you know, like with the retail, don't feel afraid going into stuff you know nothing about, because actually, I got a much better appreciation for the game, I got to the English Golf Union well, made some good friends. Actually, you know, there's some good stuff can come out of it, and you can bring different things to that job. So don't be afraid, throw yourself into it.
Very nice, very nice. Sil, so much of what you said resonated, as always. When you talk about the Brave story, I remember the conversation we had when effectively you asked me to pitch Brave, so I did, and you trusted me to do it, and you talk about trusting your people a lot and going for it. And when you know, hearing you say that actually you weren't feeling brave enough, that's a massive thing to admit, and you didn't admit that at the time. And the fact that you can do that now, is that part of you on your braver journey, kind of, you know, knowing that you can, it's okay to admit these things?
You know, I'm generally very open. I wasn't open about that because I think I was too terrified, you know. So there is lots that I'll talk
Hopefully
about.
Not
but,
me.
but in all honesty, part of why I love being the president of the society is this is my journey. This is what I'm learning. And I don't know how you guys felt, but I've been absolutely blown away by what we've experienced today. And what it does is it's unpicking the myths around bravery and decoding it so that we can, you know, make that journey step by step. So I think it is the things we fear the most that we don't talk about, and honestly, not a plug for what we're doing, but in my heart of hearts, that's what the society is out there to change. That's our agenda, and I can tell you guys, it is making a massive difference to my leadership.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Thank you. And I honestly did not ask her to say that at all. A lot of what we talked about today, and from our brilliant Caroline at the beginning of the day, who I know inspired us all, she talked about being yourself. That's where she started off with. And it sounds like, you know, Michelle, with you in first time in retail, you know, bringing yourself to the job was so incredibly important. Mm. So how did you just throw yourself straight in, or did you feel you had to be someone else first? Or?
Well, I am naturally very empathetic. Mm. And so I wanted so desperately to make sure that I could connect on a real level with the people who I was working with. I've always felt that way. And And yet, like I said, the experience that they had in this case spanned decades and minutia and such technical expertise that I finally realized that that was a road to nowhere, and took a step back and recognized that if I allowed my experience to only reside in a marketing box, that I wouldn't be bringing the benefit of an external perspective into the business. And so I kind of had to force myself to do it, because it was breaking out of that, I understand you, I'm being empathetic, thing that I really want to do. And one of the things that I did is I found the negotiation skills course that all of the Tesco buyers go on. It's super intense, 3-day residential course, and I took my team on it.
Oh, wow.
And we went on it. And so we got a lot of the sort of like fast forward on some of the vernacular and stages of negotiation, et cetera, that is just bread and butter for my retail colleagues, and that really helped.
And when you talked earlier about acronyms and the different language in retail, I mean, that's something we talk about a lot, and one of my pet hates running the Marketing Society is marketing jargon, and particularly acronyms. How did you get through that? Because a lot of times people sit in a room and there's lots of acronyms, particularly in technology, and it sounds like in retail too, where they don't understand, but they're too afraid to say, actually, I don't know what this is. So how did you,
well, I don't
how
know
did you get through
about
that?
You guys, but I feel like I've failed. I'm using them all. One of the things that I really, really fought hard against when I joined Tesco was the referring to people as the work level that they sit in. And I was like, I am not doing that. This is ridiculous. You know, I will say director instead of work level 4. I will say manager instead of work level 3. But you catch me now, and I'll be just like, yeah, let's get a work level 3 to work on it. So
wow.
I think you have to. Be really cognizant of who your audience is. And I wouldn't say that except in an environment where that is the way people speak and the way they understand things. So enough of a shift of my weight towards the language that is understood, I think is helpful.
Thank you. So why do you think leaders, and we had lots of conversations about this, are not prepared to show their human side, their vulnerable side? Why do you think that is?
I think there's a lot of places where either it's not safe, mm-hmm. or people aren't willing to break through to make it safe. So, for example, one of the things that really shifted our culture in Diageo was when we created a leadership course. And, you know, a lot of people create a leadership course by outsourcing it to another company. We didn't do that. And interestingly, the exec themselves, I wasn't on the exec at this time, the exec themselves wrote the course. And then I was asked to join them as part of the faculty. And the way we delivered the program was through personal stories. And when you see, you know, your CEO saying, you know, the most personal things, and your CFO talking about his vulnerability and, you know, how he grew up, and the CEO, you know, being at this time a little bit concerned about performance and determined to put it right and saying, I will not let you down, with his voice breaking, that shifts the culture. But then you've got to keep it going. And I think it is up to all of us as leaders. You know, one of the things I really hope people take away from here is brave isn't some sort of, you know, that you go out and do. Our role as leaders is to make it easier for people to be authentically who they are. And it's up to us to create that safe environment. And it's up to us to be brave enough to pierce it when it doesn't feel safe, to be the one to say, I don't know, I'm afraid. I've literally had no one who's ever worked directly for me who hasn't cried in a meeting. Now, maybe that says something about my leadership, but I hope it says something about how comfortable they feel to be open.
Thank you. And we're running out of time, so I'm just going to see. My team are going to kill me. But are there any questions in the audience for our three brilliant leaders? We've got some. Where are we?
Hello, 1, 2.
Really hard to see.
Hello, Gemma,
top.
Back row.
Oh, wonderful. Hello. If you just say who you are and keep your question really short, please.
Nick from Steamco. Cool. There's a lovely phrase.
Nick.
We all have two lives. Our second life starts when we realise we only have one. I run a creativity charity to get creativity into schools, and we were talking at lunch about a word for the theme for next year in this fragmented world, and we thought about Together, which the Co-op and the BBC have used. Seth Godin says that art is what we call it when what we do might connect us. So my word is connect. What word describes your brave leadership and what might be a theme for next year's conference?
Great question, but not a short question hitting the brief there. My
we
goodness.
Just do one word.
As much as lovely Nick is, so one word, let's do that. And I think that's going to have to be the last question, annoyingly. So each of you. Shall I start with you, Michelle?
Sure, I'll say generous.
Nice.
Liberational.
Vulnerable.
And on that note, thank you so much. That was a brilliant, brilliant conversation. And I'm...